The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest, and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing, interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy, because being human is the common denominator for us all. So, welcome to Secure in Mind. It has been quite a number of months since I've recorded anything because, like most people around the world, I succumbed for a matter of weeks to COVID, unfortunately, but back on track now. So I hope everyone is well wherever you are listening to this. Today's guest is Christopher Ahlberg. And Christopher and I met at an event a number of months prior to my forced bedtime in Munich at the Munich Cybersecurity Conference. It's related to the Munich Security Conference. It really focuses on the digital security, the digital aspect. So we were in a closed-door session about effectively a pitch session describing each other's activities. And we went around the table and we sat next to each other and then we decided maybe it would be a good idea to do a podcast. So I'm very excited about this because I have known a lot, at least on the periphery of recorded future. But I couldn't put my finger on all the bits and pieces that the company does. So who better person to speak to than the source and the co-founder? So welcome to the show, Christopher.
Thank you so much. Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So maybe let's walk it back perhaps a bit before Recorded Future and set the stage for how you came to be in a position where you have co-founded Recorded Future.
Yeah, no. So my background, I'm a computer scientist. I did a PhD in computer science in data visualization and how to visualize and analyze very large data sets before people talked about, I guess now it's all AI and machine learning. Back then we sort of were boring and called it data analysis and data visualization at some level and built the first company out of that where we did a lot of work in among other things, intelligence, and which took us down the path that eventually became Recorded Future, diving a little bit more deep into that, but that's the background.
Okay, so data. What kind of data sets were you did you have access to at the time and were you amassing?
Back then, this was really about what we thought about sort of highly technical but high impact data sets. We worked on things like pharmaceutical research, people who were analyzing data sets for new drugs. We looked on helping people finding oil fields, or you know, exploring data around oil fields, to getting it closer to the world of cyber. We did a lot of work on data sets and intelligence. These were data sets like you'd gotten your hands on a whole bunch of hard drives and had extracted documents from those that you turned into data. You wanted to analyze the, call it the whereabouts of people and places and organizations over times and patterns. You wanted to look at call data records to go after bad guys. This is sort of in the whole era of counterterrorism. It was the early mid 2000s sort of cycle and had some pretty insightful insights from that sort of led us down the path to what became Recorded Future.
Okay, so walk us through some of the practicalities of ingesting large amounts of data. Let's say you have access to X amount of hard drives. How do you categorize and organize the data so it's easily sifted through and you can act on it?
Yeah, no, it's great, and it's a good question, and it actually will lead us nicely down into the future world here. So it's great. I'm glad you're asking that. So imagine you start with a bunch of hard drives. Have some bullet holes through them and these sort of things, you know, like, so you start doing the work on extracting first the physical, sort of going after the physics of that. And we didn't work on that part. There's other people who are very good at that. You get the actual content of the hard drives. You know, you might find a back in the day outlook.pst file, you know, the terrorist's email too, it turns out, or other sort of documents. And you start doing then to turn these documents into data. That's a tricky part because you've got a bunch of documents. But now you have to, so then you will then apply techniques like very sort of natural language processing techniques. People like to call it entity extraction to go look for people's names, places, organizations, time points, facilities, all these sort of things. And now you're getting closer to data when you can start making relationships between these things. And it's tricky because, you know, take a simple name, like, just to make it, you know, simplistic, Osama bin Laden, that, you know, you can spell it in probably 10, 15 different ways in English, let alone UBL, OBL. Every agency had its own way of sort of how to name it. And then you had, you know, the Arabic version of writing it and the Hebrew version, the Farsi version. You very quickly get into pretty interesting problems, even with the sort of information that you get off somebody's hard drive. And then turning that into sort of analytics, there was a famous example of after the Enron scandal, people got the data sets of all the emails going around inside Enron and trying to analyze that. It's wonderfully challenging, but lots of interesting problems as a computer scientist, but also from a sort of analytic problem. So pretty interesting.
Can you give us a sense of how radically it's changed over the past, say, 15 years from, you know, especially so the great example that you gave of 15 different ways to perhaps, I think George Bush was famous in pronouncing it about five different ways himself, but Al-Qaeda. Can you give me a sense of how much that has evolved over the last number of years?
Yeah, no, so it has. So the world has gotten better at this. The even better example is actually Muammar al-Qaddafi, who even on his own website would spell his own name in 11 different ways. So that was sort of famous old example when he was still in power. But
you got to wonder whether about his ideology then, if he can't be consistent with his own name.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's the, is it deliberate or not? But and it turns out that there has been progress in this sort of natural language processing, and that sort of became, in many ways, the underpinning for what we are doing in Recorded Future, or at Recorded Future, especially in the world of text processing. So there has been progress. There's a lot of, you know, Google has been sort of a big investor in all of that and built a lot of cool technology. There is technology that has come out of the intelligence community, and they actually have been pretty good about publishing and sharing that technology. I think there is something pretty cool in this. I obviously talk about sort of counterterrorism examples here that can seem a little bit intimidating, but there is something pretty profound about how the internet has made us as a planet, as a, you know, humanity, sharing in languages in a way that we, you know, haven't done before. Google Translate, you go on there, you can sort of, you know, go back and forth across languages in ways that have really been enabled by a natural language processing revolution. And then, you know, I want to avoid getting into the very tidbits or the details of it, happy to, but it's a pretty wild thing that have happened in terms of how we can communicate and create, both analyze but also share across humanity. I think it's pretty profound.
So moving into the Recorded Future portion of life, you've set up the initial business, and then that was the basis for forming Recorded Future. Give me a sense of, you know, the beginnings of the business, and then what you are now, what you offer, and got a couple more questions after that.
So we built that first company. It was called Spotfire, sold that company, and then started thinking about, like, how the internet was starting to change the world. Back in 2008 2009, when this was, it was still relatively early days, but the world's information was moving on to the internet faster than it's ever done, you know, just like into one place, and again, across languages, for example. At the same time, the world sort of, call them bad actors, have also started to figure out that if you want to steal information or steal money, the most sort of effective place to do that probably is the internet. And you can delete the word probably, because it is. So if it's spies who are interested in stealing information, they sort of latched onto this. I can use the internet as my vector to go steal information. If I'm a criminal, the most effective way to steal money is via the internet. So and so what we realized was that, ooh, this is interesting. What about if I could, instead of thinking about those hard drives, actually just think about the internet as the information source, but then also think about the trails that bad guys will leave behind themselves when they're trying to either steal money or secrets.
Okay, so always trails. What kind of trails?
you know, it can be anything from the very open to, you know, the not so open. So the very open are things like people's, you know, you think about intent. Yes, countries have intents. They have policies. Mm. You know, so if I want to get in the heads of what Chinese leadership wants, the internet will be a good reflection of that. If I'm good about it, if I'm smart, if I try to analyze that. So that's sort of at the highest sort of levels. Mm. You go down further down all the way in, into the world of sort of more cyberish stuff. You know, if you see an actor, be it a criminal or a spy, who's going to go after a certain set of targets, he's going to create phishing domains that relates to that target. He's going to set up certificate infrastructures. He's going to create malware that is related to that target. He's going to probably leave NetFlow sort of traces behind. We can keep drilling into the core of the internet. And what we sort of said was, we want to index and organize and set up for analysis this information all the way from that sort of intent-oriented data all the way down to the, I like to say the electrons, and maybe that's a little bit exaggerating, but as far into the core of the internet as you can, and then make that available for analysis to the guy who's, or the woman who's trying to get to these criminals and spies and what have you.
It's interesting. It reminds me of a recent article by, I can't remember their names, Bjørnar and Stig from Norway. Beijingology 2.0, Bridging the Art and Science of China Watching in Xi Jinping's New Era. Yeah, it was, I mean, it touches on a lot of what you're mentioning, and the smart collation of, say, sources of the daily editions of People's Daily, the CPC's official media org. And then you have a large enough data set, you can draw out trends from there. Well, interesting.
China is very opaque in many ways. You know, many things we are used to in the West, that you want to understand what a politician is doing, you call him up as a journalist, you ask him, he's likely to talk to you. You call up a Chinese politician and ask him, what are you up to? And he's just kind of like, what?
Why would I tell you? However, the copious amounts of documents describing the activities in the bureaucratic matter that is.
So now you have to go after other sort of ways.
Yeah.
And I could talk for days about ways that we've gotten into the heads of Chinese, you know, whether it's the intelligence apparatus or other aspects of it. And you can, China leaves trails just like the Russians do, just like in the Western sort of intelligence agencies do. And with the Recorded Future, we've tried to say, if we index this data, we organize it, we can get under the skin of it and help our clients understand very hard questions.
Okay, so give us an example. Obviously, you can't go into specific details for clients, but give us an example of a hard question.
Study. That's good. I'll do sort of one that is sort of, so that is not necessarily super hard, but it's very frequent. And then I'll do one that is sort of more of a deeper one that will relate to China.
Perfect.
So I think there are repetitive tasks that happen all the time. You know, you think about, again, companies who are interested in, you know, when we look to all our clients, they want to sort of repetitively catch the people who are trying to build malicious infrastructure targeting their company. They're setting up not just one, but any number of phishing domains. They're connecting those domains to actual computers. They're setting certificates related to them, mail service related to them, everything that's needed to sort of weaponize this infrastructure. And historically, that's had to be an analyst who sort of clicks through a whole bunch of steps to do that. And by just mass ingesting this sort of data and taking those patterns that an analyst had traditionally had to do step by step by step, we can catch those and automatically remediate them, and you know, which sort of takes that task and makes it, you know, that you'd arguably call historically an intelligence task, and you just automate it and you make it go away. And we can do that even, you know, at any scale for any sort of company and organization. So that, you know, it's a repetitive task and it's an important task, but it doesn't feel like James Bond doing it. But it's because if you do that consistently, you make it harder for the bad guy. So that's sort of at the simple level, but it's important and it's very you know, it's like everybody has the problem.
So a question on that. Let's say you are working with an intelligence partner from, I don't know, a Five Eye country, like one of the countries that I'm from, and you're tasked with identifying this particular case where you have an analyst for X country who is tasked. Their specific role within the hierarchy is to set up the infrastructure, the C2 infrastructure. Where does Recorded Future stop? Because you may be furnishing the information, but you wouldn't have any active role beyond that. That would be for the intelligence partner, I would hazard a guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, you know, our clients are probably 70% custom, what do you want to call them, companies, commercial organizations, and then 30% government. And it doesn't matter if it's a government or a company, we will set this up for them and they run it and they operate it.
Okay.
In fact, that's sort of a generally very smart approach in life to sort of enable, that's sort of part of our mission statement, really, to enable our clients to do this stuff. And especially, to be honest, especially if it's an intelligence agency of some sort, because you don't want to get involved. And we have probably 30 nation states who are clients in themselves, in the what I like to refer the West and its allies and its friends, kind of to what you'll say. And among them, but that doesn't mean that those guys agree on everything. So we, you know, we will say, here's the technology and we will work with you. And among those people who are the West and the friends and the allies, and then you do it. So that's sort of a key portion, you know, not to get yourself caught up in people's intents and what they're up to, basically.
No, absolutely. I mean, your role is as an information furnisher, and then the client does what they will with that information. So it's slightly, say, different if you are, for argument's sake, of a firewall, a firewall vendor, or even an IDS that can proactively block any potential intrusion. And so then you have more onus over the decision, but it's you know, I guess it's chalk and cheese because you're comparing utilization of information.
You could end up with sensitive cases, whether it's a firewall or, you know, so effectively our data will feed into firewalls and other IDSs or what have you, all kinds of different systems. So you could imagine somebody would try to manipulate us, somebody would try to do all kinds of different things. And we have never and we will never listen to anything of that sort.
Yep.
And again, we're sort of 30 different countries rely on us, plus, you know, a whole bunch of commercial companies. And I think once you take one little step in the direction where you compromise on that, you're dead.
You're done. Yeah, you've lost.
Now you're a government, like whatever governments ask you to do that, and you do it, now you're a tool of theirs rather than a company.
Yeah,
we don't want to be a tool of somebody else. That's sort of a simple thing too. But now, so that's the simple example. If you want to, I'll give you a more sort of a bigger story. It's a little bit of a story, but it's cool. Oh, it shows you again.
I would love to hear absolutely the second story. I do have a second question about the initial use case. Let's say what are the types of countermeasures that analysts would be integrating, or the overarching, you know, the internal auditor within X government's apparatus be implementing in order to obfuscate their movements so they're not detected by your pattern recognition systems.
Yeah, no, it's obviously, you know, ongoing battle. So, you know, we've been working on these sort of phishing domains for a long time now, 6-7 years sort of thing. And, you know, whether it's something where you do look at the simple, you know, somebody produces these, you know, they use the dynamic DNS registrars where they can sort of,
you know, flux.
They'll put Apple and Walmart inside these mega domains sort of thing. And there are all kinds of subdomains. We think we get more subdomains in the world than anybody. So you can sort of look for the simple stuff, but you could also apply more sophisticated sort of machine learning models that you train on this stuff. Now, you know, recently we see more and more of these guys who use phishing domains that just don't rely on the actual domain name at all, you know, so if it's something targeting, I don't know, you know, Apple or Walmart or whoever, it doesn't even include that in the domain, but the landing page will include it. So we can go look for that. We'll have algorithms that will look for the logos of said companies in those landing pages. So we probably observe I don't know, tens of thousands, maybe low hundreds of thousands of phishing pages every day. I think that's true. And then we look for some 7,000 different company and organizational logos in those constantly every X minutes. And so it's work that a human can't pull off, frankly.
So
that's sort of one example of where this is. And you're seeing these sort of things escalating constantly, but that's sort of part of the game.
The
bad guy will try to, you know, find all kinds of different ways to do it. So that, but that's what makes this job fun.
I was just going to say, in truth, that's actually the fun stuff.
I always say I get paid to do something that I would do for free, probably.
And then the tip of the hat, it's like, oh, wow, they actually did that. So we now have to beat that. But well played, sir.
So
the second use case, let's jump into that.
So that's a little bit more of a research use case. But that can't be automated, but it's sort of interesting. So one of the things in this world is sort of the use of vulnerabilities. Obviously, so bad guys will take advantage of software vulnerabilities to in various sorts. So and at the same time, the same countries where these bad guys reside in, they also are working on the defensive side of things and trying to tell their constituents, their countries, and the general world that they should patch these vulnerabilities. So we've been very interested in this, and we've tracked the National Vulnerability Database in the U.S. and Japan and Russia and China and so on over long periods of time. So one thing that struck us was that we should benchmark the U.S. and the Chinese one. Just sort of turns out that the Japanese and the Russian ones have less coverage. We can come talk about that separately. But the Chinese and the U.S. have very similar coverage. So we started benchmarking them. But first found that the Chinese were actually faster than the Americans at reporting on software vulnerabilities. So we said, oh, that's interesting. So we published that report, and it went to all kinds of good places around the world where it, and we actually think it got the American vulnerability apparatus to work faster. The report got some nice sort of spread in China. They liked it, sort of things. We could track them. We track where it goes and all that stuff. So that was sort of step one. That was interesting. Then we kept looking at this data because we sort of constantly have a refreshed version of this data. We started looking at, ooh, I wonder, and we realized that sometimes with CNMVD, which is run by CINITAC, which is a couple of steps up, is run by MSS, Ministry of State Security, that is also a very prominent offensive part of the Chinese intelligence apparatus. So it sort of comes up to the same nexus. We realized that sometimes they actually sit on vulnerabilities for 9 months, 10 months, 11 months, 12 months. So that was sort of like, oh, I guess that makes sense. And then we looked at those vulnerabilities and could see that that vulnerabilities were also being used in attacks. They're like, ooh, now we can see it. Now, now we actually sort of, again, you know, China is not going to state a word about this, but the digital exhaust by something that they set up for good intent actually reveals. So now you have a tipping, function of theirs there of what vulnerabilities they're going to use. So we ended up with a lot of debates about whether we were going to publish or share this or keep it quiet. Sort of gives us a unique way into something that they didn't know that somebody had figured out. But we kept the screenshots of the dates of like where when they published this stuff. And eventually we were like, Recorded Future is a defensive company. It's our job to help the world, not to sort of know this particular thing. We want to, the biggest impact we can have on the world is to tell the world this. So then we published published this paper and said, look, China is holding back on this stuff and da-da-da. So we did. And that obviously, that report got zero sort of spread in China for obvious reasons and so on.
And then, what did you notice happened after that, the release of that report? You know, the tactics changed instantly?
But the interesting part, then we waited a couple of more months, and then it turns out they went back and retrofitted their database to make it look like they never did it in the first place. And then we published a report.
The beauty of screenshots.
And then we put on that with the screenshots that showed them that they had showed that they had changed the dates. And then from there on, we knew that we were the the top hated party in China. No Chinese trips for me. and for us. But that's sort of that's not a easy click repeat example, but it's an example where you can get to intent and you can get to capability, which many times, you know, you think about threat analysis or, you know, when you do intelligence, what you want to is you want to understand intent, you want to understand capability. And this gives you a glimpse into capability for sure, very specifically so, and then a general glimpse into intent, which we found to be very interesting.
It is very interesting. I was actually moderating a panel session at FIC, the French Cybersecurity Forum, and we had the Deputy Cyber Command, Colonel François Vagnon, Laurent Bernard from the OECD, Octavia Devert from BNIP, and then Gilles Lyonnais from Yes We Hack. And the topic of conversation was coordinated vulnerability disclosure. And we were also touching on the inevitable and perennial tension between competing slightly loggerhead incentives and requirements of the same government. And we were talking kind of in the French context.
Very interesting.
It's really difficult to put your finger on the best fit.
The U.S. has sort of a very elaborate and public vulnerabilities equities process that, you know, the enemies of the United States or even the skeptics are not going to believe it, but I think it's well run. It's sort of, you know, the UK, I think, has something similar, you know, that is well run as well. China and Russia probably could care less about this stuff. But what will be very interesting, exactly to your point, is in the EU, when the EU want to harmonize and organize their cyber defense, but then every EU member state practically is starting to build offensive cyber capabilities.
Yeah.
As soon as you build offense, and the really interesting thing is that if you're going to build offensive cyber, either you buy it from some terrible company like NSO, or you actually build it on your own. But if you're going to build it on your own, you have to, sort of by the very nature of it, hold back on vulnerabilities from your publication, kind of to my Chinese example. And the only effect of that is that you're going to now suddenly be keeping your specific country, like what China did in this case. They held back on vulnerability. And nobody in the whole world looks at CNMVD to direct their patching except for China. So as soon as you say, I want to build an offensive cyber capability, you are, by the very nature of that statement, saying, I want to keep my own population less patched. And I think it's very interesting. And the EU is going to be caught up in something very interesting there.
Yeah, it is. As you know, the financial gateway, the financial toll for access into the world of constructing and building your offensive capabilities reduces. I mean, and also, I mean, even paying third-party suppliers. I mentioned NSO, which is more the gold standard, but then you have Beltrox and other organizations which are a tenth the cost. So access is minimal now. It's I recall at the cybersecurity conference where the discussion with something that I help advise, which is an interesting project, which is suggesting that there's actually, because of these dynamics, there is no fix within the current model, because regardless of whether you're China, the United States, or any other country, you will absolutely run into that inevitable checks and balance choice. Yeah. Now, the suggested the proposal, as far fetched as it may sound, from my the guy who works on this organization called Trustless, was to actually, rather than design backdoors for want of a better word, but design a legal front door which can be accessed by multiple states and parties, managed in neutral neutral location. Don't get me started on how to actually affect a neutral location as well, because then we can open up a big can of worms about, you know, Crypto AG riding on the fact that it was in a neutral zone, but it totally wasn't. Great boon for Western intelligence.
Switzerland, US, American,
However, in this utopian concept, theoretically, you could have Russia, China, United States, and Israel knocking on the same legally designed front door for their legitimate access activities. Now, of course, the complexity in implementing something like that is huge, and also you know, companies want to keep their edge.
And so. I think it's so if you set the technical complexities aside, because the technical complexities would be enormous, and there will be both your friends and your adversaries are going to look to take advantage of those technical things.
Because we're not going to eliminate the human out of this.
So that's one. Yeah. But then on the other hand, I also think that, you know, again, from a defensive point of view, it is possible to have alliances, I think, you know, like they truly are. And whether it's Europe or Europe and US, and I'll actually tie this back to Rupert Fisher soon here. But then as soon as you put the offensive side, you will look to your own country. Yeah. It's this, you know, like it's very hard to do offensive cyber and in a way that it's sort of where you don't have your own country's sort of interest at first in mind. Mm. And so to combine it, I think it's fantasy. And even if it's not fantasy in intent, it will be fantasy on the back door when people will look to take advantage of whatever thing you cook up.
Absolutely.
But we think now, on the other hand, I think, and we think at Recorded Future, that there is an amazing opportunity where, again, the West, its friends and its allies, have, you know, tried to tried to sort of balance out what the bad guys are doing with information sharing and saying, look, if we share IOCs and da da da. But unfortunately, after 10 or 20 years of that stuff, it obviously hasn't really moved the needle.
Yeah.
But one of the things that excites us is that how they're now, you know, there are probably 50 of these national cyber defensive capabilities to CISA in the US and CSC in the UK and INCB in Israel and da, 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 around the world. And these organizations, if they could be much better at sharing, not necessarily the IOCs, because many reasons, they may not even be very interested in doing that. Hmm. But in sharing in the analytical TTPs of how to go after the bad guys, there is an amazing opportunity there.
And that seems like a nice halfway measure.
And we have 30 of these now as our clients. Hmm. And we're working proactively to come up with sort of an intelligence kit that we can use to share across these guys and work together to come up with analytical procedures that can, you know, help neutralize the bad guy and do that as a community. And I think there could be an enormous headway to be done in all of that.
Interesting. It also reminds me, actually, the other initiative that I'm working on is bona fide research, the one that I mentioned is at FIC and also CyberSec. So I'll have to chat to you after the show, because that's also, it's supporting the OECD in their efforts to advise their members and non-member countries about the necessity to enhance coordinated vulnerability and disclosure, like legislation around CVD and also safe harbor. And it kind of trickles into this this area, because many of the researchers that at least we're in touch with one of the organizations that I'm on the board of are Zero Day researchers. There are a lot of competing incentives there, especially if you're coming from an emerging market where just the economics don't make sense. Make sense in the black market and selling to...
If you were the guy at what's it called, Zerodium, I call him the guy in Malta, he's going to be thrilled that all these European countries are going to build their own, you know, you suddenly got 27 new clients. No, there's lots of weird incentives in all of this.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're basically about to wrap up. I've really enjoyed the conversation. I just wanted to ask, what's next for Recorded Future? What have you guys got in store? And how did COVID impact your operations? And how have you seen, you know, now that we're normalizing COVID life?
We sent everybody home on, what was it, March 13th or something like that in 2020. And we were sort of like, it was going to be an experiment to see, can we run a global intelligence capability used by 1,500 clients, including a bunch of the world's largest cyber defensive
Can you do it all from the bedroom?
Do it all from the bedroom. And it turns out that we could. So that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
It's quote unquote all in the cloud. You know, so yes, we could. I think, you know, we've seen that there is this, you know, intelligence is becoming a core part of cyber defense programs, whether it's in a small credit union or something very large. Mm. That's exciting. And the appetite out there is an enormous one. we're trying to consume more and more kinds of data. You know, I talked about sort of machine type data. I talked about sort of things that requires vision, like the logo detection, computer vision, natural language processing. We just acquired a company in Holland or Netherlands called Hatching that allows us to do malware processing better than we think pretty much anybody. So like getting into code consumption in itself or executable consumption. So this getting into all the different types of data that lives on the internet is sort of certainly a key path, but then at the same time, figure out how you make intelligence consumable up and down the stack, whether it's sort of your political, you know, and I love the fact that you're talking about these political leaders, you know, all the way down to sort of the technical operator. How do you do that up and down the stack where it's consumable and meaningful and so on? So it's a not a never-ending challenge, but it's fun.
Well, very good to hear. Christopher, I really enjoyed this conversation. I look forward to catching up again somewhere in the world now that conferences are a thing. So I guess if you have no other additional...
No, it's good. Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
No worries. Thank you very much.
The Secure in Mind project aims to raise public awareness, interest and capacity of all things online in our rapidly developing interconnected world. We interview top leaders in associated fields to understand what they do, why they do it, and importantly, we aim to present the human behind the policy because being human is the common denominator for us all.